Our next case is another immigration case, Hilton versus the Attorney General. Good morning, Mr. Fogel. I know this
morning,
is
Your Honor.
not your first appearance before us.
It isn't, Your Honor. It's good to see you again.
See you.
May it please the court. My name is H. Glenn Fogel Jr. And I represent the petitioner in this case, Mr. Matthew Hilton. And the issue is to whether a naturalized citizen of the U.S. is removable for a conviction of crimes while a U.S. citizen is undeniably in the negative. This court found in Adams on this exact same issue that was so easily decided that they issued a per curiam opinion consisting of only two paragraphs.
That seemed like maybe we need a published opinion now.
I would say so, but I just, you know, even in the two paragraphs, this is what, you know, this is what the court said.
It doesn't Costello really tell us everything we need to know about this case?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I think that Costello is, you know, I think Costello is very clear. Costello obtained his naturalization through fraud.
So we don't need a published opinion. We just say see Costello.
Well, the Board of Immigration Appeals has thrown some obfuscation into the matter and basically said, you know, that Costello isn't good law anymore. And I, you know, it's just, that's just wrong. A number of, you know, this isn't a huge issue where you can find a lot of courts have talked about this, but the courts that have looked at this, other than the one case in the Third Circuit, one unpublished case in the Third Circuit, have all followed Costello. But, you know, this court said, you know, in Adams, that the wording of the statute.
And it's not just the board. I mean, the government is here to tell us today that we owe some Chevron deference to the board's interpretation here, right?
Well, you know, that's what the government says in every case. And every case that gets reversed, we're not given Chevron
that's
deference.
That's not fair. I mean, the government doesn't say that in every case.
Well, that's their usual argument. They always go to Chevron deference. If Chevron deference, you know, in every case, then there would be no case ever reversed. The point is, when the BIA misapplies the law, as they did here, this court should reverse them. I mean, correct them and show them what, you know, the correct meaning and the correct reading of the law. And the correct reading of the law is the correct reading of Costello is that if a person commits a crime while they're a U.S. citizen, they're not deportable for that crime, even when they're done that, you know, even when they lose their citizenship at a later time.
So the wording of the statute that we're reviewing here is not exactly the same as the wording of the statute in Costello. Is there a material difference?
No, there's not a material difference. It's
why not?
Well, there's not a material difference because the word is, I mean, the verb is the, you know, is the controlling verb here. Like when the Fifth Circuit in the Ocpala case looked at the same thing, they said that there's no material difference between, and this is exact same situation as Mr. Hilton here that was in Ocpala. The, you know, the Fifth Circuit said there's no material difference. What we're talking about is, you know, this was back in the 60s, it's talking about deportation and we talk about removal now, but it's the same thing. And it's talking about a different statute under the deportable statutes, which were, you know, two crimes involving moral turpitude as opposed to an aggravated felony here. But the only difference is, you know, it's the word removal and the crime.
So what do we do with this? Costello said that, all right, so let's make sure we got this right. All right, so the provision here says any alien who is convicted of an aggravated felony at any time after admission In Costello, it's any alien who at any time after entry is convicted of two crimes involving moral turpitude. So the at any time after entry is placed in different parts of the statute, but otherwise it's really about any alien who's convicted, right? Is convicted. That's your point about the word is. But Costello itself, the Supreme Court acknowledged, read alone, that that language was susceptible to two possible readings, which last time I checked, you know, if languages can be read one of two ways plausibly, that's the definition of ambiguity. Why doesn't that mean we have to give Chevron deference here?
Well, again, you look at the plain meaning of the statute, and the other controlling word here, apart from the word, I mean, the verb is alien. Okay, and when you're not an alien, if you're a citizen, and if so, that's the whole point. If you're an alien, you're deportable. But when you're a naturalized citizen, you're not an alien anymore. Therefore, if you commit a crime when you're not an alien, you can't be deported for that. I mean, that's just, you know, that's just logical. And the second,
you know, but I mean, the Supreme Court said in Costello, you could read that to permit deportation only of a person who was an alien at the time of his conviction, or, and I'm quoting the Supreme Court, permit deportation of a person now an alien who at any time after entry has been convicted of two crimes, regardless of his status at the time of the convictions. That the Supreme Court said that was one possible reading too, right?
Well, that went to that relation, that went to the relation back provision in the statute. And the bottom line is they came out with a holding. I mean, the holding in Costello is what it is, that you cannot be deported.
I guess it isn't really the argument that yes, that's what the court said you could do if the provision was read standing alone. But when you then apply ordinary canons of interpretation, the better interpretation is that it means what you say it means, including the canon that you resolve the ambiguity in favor of the alien.
Right, that's the rule. You know, the rule of lenity, which is the rule of lenity. I keep always mispronounce that. The rule of lenity, and that's what this court previously said in Adams. I mean, they gave four reasons. One of them was the rule of lenity.
And let me ask you a question, Mr. Fogel, about the relation back issue. In section 1451, it seems to me, or I read it as saying there's a civil proceeding for denaturalization, and there's also a criminal proceeding. Is it correct that Mr. Hilton was denaturalized under 1451E, which is the criminal proceeding?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. Yes. Okay. I mean, they didn't go through the civil denaturalization, correct.
Okay, but in Costello, the petitioner had been denaturalized under 1451A, which has slightly different language than 1451E. Does that make any difference to your argument?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I mean, denaturalization is denaturalization, whether whether it's civil or criminal.
Well, 1450E contains the language saying that the original order was void. And I don't see that language in 1451A.
It's not, but it's still, it's void as of, again, it's void as of the date of the order. So that's the date of the order denaturalizing the person.
It's made a nullity from the point of conviction going forward, but there's nothing in it to suggest that it has a relation back for these purposes.
Correct. I think that makes this argument even stronger because there's no relation back issue. But again, I mean, that was the same case, you know, Adams had the same issue. Adams was a criminal denaturalization as well. Ocpala was a criminal denaturalization. One other thing I just wanted to point out to the court, I mean, in preparation for this argument, there's two other appellate cases that that discuss the reading of Costello and agree with this court's reading. One of them is a D.C. Circuit case called United States versus Straker, which is 800 F3rd 570. This is a 2015 case. It was a completely different issue, but they agree. You know, they agree with Costello and the Costello's reading, and it's in a completely different scenario in a criminal case with the kidnapping of American citizens.
Okay.
But then there's another case.
Mr. Fogle?
Yes, sir.
Your time has expired.
Okay. All right. I'll reserve my 5 minutes.
Thank you, Ms. Nahas.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Rebecca Nahas for the United States Attorney General. Petitioner committed armed bank robbery while he was a lawful permanent resident, and he concealed this criminal activity in his notice of naturalization oath.
But he was a citizen when he was convicted, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He was a citizen when he was convicted.
Correct. He concealed this criminal activity in his notice of naturalization oath, showing that he knew immigration consequences would attach to his criminal activity. Shortly after he was naturalized through his fraud and convicted of armed bank robbery as a naturalized citizen, he was then denaturalized.
If he's a citizen when convicted, why doesn't Costello resolve this in his favor?
Sure, Your Honor. The government's position is that this statute, the removability statute, the aggravated felony statute, is ambiguous under Costello, and that the agency's interpretation of this statute as applying to any alien, regardless of their status of conviction.
My problem is this: it seems to me that the Supreme Court applied canons of interpretation to resolve any possible ambiguity. And concluded that the better interpretation is the one that favors the petitioner here. And because the Supreme Court interpreted that materially similar language in that manner, we are obliged to interpret materially similar language in the same manner here. Why is that not the case?
Three points. First, as Your Honor pointed out earlier, this statute was found to be ambiguous by the
Standing alone. Court. Standing alone, right? Before they Correct. Applied the canon.
But that goes to Chevron step one, right? Chevron step one didn't exist at the time of Costello. The court then went on, after finding that the statute was ambiguous, to interpret the statute. And it did so based on a provision providing for a judicial recommendation against deportation, which
that
is
was
no
one
longer,
ground, and there was another separate and independent ground
for rule of lenity. Correct, Your Honor. But under step two, the agency gets discretion to define ambiguous terms.
Yeah, and but so the problem is the Supreme Court of the United States resolved that ambiguity in one statute that uses the same language before the passage of this statute. And I don't see how the agency can then say that that they're going to resolve that ambiguity a different way after it's received that prior construction from the Supreme Court of the United States.
Well, Your Honor, I think Brand X resolves that question. Brand X, the Supreme Court explained that stare decisis only applies to judicial interpretations of unambiguous statutes. This is not the Supreme Court and Costello acknowledged that this was an ambiguous statute.
Only standing alone.
I'm not sure what you mean by that, Your Honor, but in terms of
step one. I mean, before you apply the canons of interpretation.
Right, but I guess the idea is step one is whether the statute is ambiguous or not. And if it is, then the agency has that authority and discretion.
Do you have a case where the Supreme Court has said, yes, we've interpreted this, what could be read as ambiguous language, applied canons, and resolved the ambiguity in one direction, and then Congress comes behind and passes another statute using the same language, and and the agency says, well, we're going to resolve the ambiguity a different way. And the Supreme Court says, oh yeah, you can do that, despite what we had earlier said that language means when we authoritatively construed it.
Your Honor, I can cite Neguse for that proposition. That is a case I cited in my brief. And in that case, the agency was interpreting the persecutor bar and whether it had a duress exception. And the agency found itself bound by Fedorenko, which was a prior Supreme Court precedent that interpreted a similar statute under the Displaced Persons Act. The board said, we're bound by Fedorenko. There's no duress exception. It went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court sent it back to the agency, said, no, this statute is ambiguous. It's a different provision than the one at issue in Fedorenko.
So they didn't think that it really was controlled by the earlier case. They didn't
correct,
say
because it was
materially different, wasn't it?
Well, it was different in I think in a similar way that the provision before the court is different than the one in Castello. The court found the judicial recommendation against deportation to be a really critical part of its construction of the statutory scheme. If you go through Castello, they said that, there's these two plausible interpretations, but a former 1251B2, the JRAD provision, quote, shed considerable light on the issue. They also said that the qualifying provision was an important part of the legislative scheme. They also said to adopt a contrary interpretation would completely nullify a procedure so intrinsic a part of the legislative scheme. Right. So the courts.
My problem is though, the use of the lenity rule, right, was an alternative ground for its construction, wasn't it?
It was, it said this,
So the deportation recommendation issue is really, it seems to me, a red herring, because the Supreme Court said, even with that aside, we would still reach the same conclusion about how to interpret the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, but the court was applying a statutory construction tool that only comes into play if the statute's not ambiguous or the agency doesn't provide a reasonable interpretation. The rule of lenity does not supplant a reasonable agency interpretation of an ambiguous statute.
Well, Brand X says it does, because Brand X says when you apply the rule of lenity, that is a canon of statutory construction that renders the statute unambiguous.
It renders the statute unambiguous.
It resolves the ambiguity.
Resolves the ambiguity, yes.
Correct, but at the same time, Your Honor, that's really invading the agency's authority to define these ambiguous terms. And the idea behind the Chevron and Brand X framework.
Here's why I don't bother, okay? Maybe if the first interpreter of the law had been the agency, we'd be talking about one thing. But the problem here is this materially similar language is authoritatively construed by the Supreme Court of the United States. And then Congress, which operates with the background principles of understanding the decisions of the Supreme Court that have since construed it materially similar language, uses the same language in another statute. And what you're saying is that despite that authoritative construction and despite the fact that Congress would be aware of that authoritative construction and then use the same language, that the agency can come behind and say, and interpret it a different way. And we have to defer to that. That's your argument, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. I think you're referring to the court's reasoning in Adams that Congress acquiesced to essentially Castello by remaining inactive.
Well, let's just put it this way. Congress is aware of the decisions of the Supreme Court across the street, right?
Sure, Your Honor, but I think that it also cuts the other way in that matter of Rossi was issued 2 years after Castello and has been in the books for 60 years, right?
And so- And counsel, it also misstated Costello, did it not?
Matter of Rossi?
Yeah, the B, Costello, quote, was in fact primarily predicated on the provisions, end of quote, allowing for a JRAD. But as Chief Judge has pointed out, after it discussed the JRAD and how that was important, it then said, but even if it didn't exist, would reach the same conclusion on the rule of lenity and other considerations. It's very punitive. And we're going to avoid that where there's ambiguity. So the BIA misinterpreted Costello as a matter of law to say it was primarily based on the JRAD.
Well, Your Honor, the rule of lenity holding, you know, was really an alternative holding that.
Yeah, but you know, alternative, that's our point. Alternative means it will stand on its own feet.
And it binds us.
Right, but it doesn't bind the agency to interpret an ambiguous statute. I don't think that the rule of lenity supplants a reasonable agency interpretation.
So your position is no JRAD. The Supreme Court comes out and says, "This we hold this is what this statute means. Period. There's ambiguity, but we resolve the ambiguity. This is what this statute means." The BIA, the next time it has a sitting, whatever they're called, a panel meet, can overrule the Supreme Court.
Under Brand X, yes, that is our position. And the reasoning, so Brand X, of course, was considering a judicial construction by a court of appeals, but the same reason—
That's a little bit different, don't you think?
Your Honor, I think that there's the 10th Circuit has come out, and I'm happy to supply this in a 28J letter, with a case explaining that Brand X would apply to a Supreme Court construction of an ambiguous term. And the reason the court provided was that the reasoning and justification underlying Brand X applies with equal force to a Supreme Court precedent. And the idea was, we don't want this to be the Chevron framework to be a race to get to the proper interpretation between the agency and the court, right? And that applies equally to the Supreme Court.
Suppose the Supreme Council, suppose Supreme Court said, this isn't ambiguous. This is what it means. Can the BIA then say, no, that's confused. We're the expert, it is ambiguous.
Sorry, if the Supreme Court said it was unambiguous or ambiguous, Your Honor?
Unambiguous.
That would be, we would be bound by that for sure.
Suppose the Supreme Court doesn't say anything about ambiguous or not ambiguous. It just says, we resolve this issue on the grounds of the rule of lenity. Then the BIA pulls up a couple of decisions that says the rule of lenity only applies if there's ambiguity. So there must have been ambiguity. So notwithstanding what the Supreme Court said, we get to overrule it.
I think that the agency would have to find the provision before it ambiguous in order for it to provide its own interpretation.
It finds it ambiguous. The Supreme Court didn't say a word about ambiguity.
I think that's a harder hypothetical, but that's not the case before the court.
Counsel, that's exactly why I asked. If the BIA says, nobody's said anything about ambiguity here, Supreme Court just held this is what the statute means. But we look at it, and we think it's ambiguous, then that means that the Supreme Court must have recognized it's ambiguous, and therefore we can overrule the Supreme Court on what it means, right?
I don't think that the agency can overrule the Supreme Court on whether a statute is ambiguous or not.
Yeah, the Supreme Court has said, when it's here, the canons supply an answer, Chevron leaves the stage. The Supreme Court has held that linguistic ambiguity does not establish ambiguity in the Chevron sense.
Well, Your Honor, Costello was clear that as Your Honor pointed out, that that provision is subject
read to- Read in isolation. It's read standing alone before you apply the canons.
But I don't think that the canon comes into play at step one. I think the canon comes into play when a statute is grievously—
Well, let me read you the Supreme Court from 3 years ago in Epic Systems. Whereas here, the canon supply an answer, Chevron leaves the stage. Doesn't that tell us we apply that we're bound by canons, including an authoritative construction by the Supreme Court?
But
and
I think
it doesn't matter if the board comes behind and then says that materially the same language means something different. We have to respect what the Supreme Court has said about its authoritative construction.
I think it depends on the construction tool before the court. And I think that the rule of lenity was intended to apply in really, some courts call it grievously ambiguous statutes, right? That we don't know how to interpret this. There is no reasonable interpretation. So let's look at the rule of lenity. And that really is at step three. I mean, there is no step three, but it's past step two. Step two is whether the ambiguous statute was reasonably interpreted by the agency. And that's really the only review that the court has. I see that I'm running out of time. I would just request that the court defer to matter of Rossi and Gonzalez-Murro and deny the petition for review. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Nahas. Mr. Fogel.
Thank you, Your Honors. And as has been made several times by the court, I mean, the Supreme Court has already resolve the ambiguity here. There's not, if there was ambiguity in the first place. And that's
before
that's,
the passage of the statute that we're dealing with, right?
That's correct, but we're dealing with the same issue. This court's already right. Looked at and said the same, you know, and said the same things that they're saying today. And if the government's argument is asking us to, you know, is asking this court to basically ignore Costello, reverse it, and follow an incorrect misreading of Costello by the BIA based on a case. I mean, from 1966. That's just
not. Is there anything that Ms. Nahas said that you want to particularly respond to?
No, Your Honors. No, I mean I've made the argument in my briefs, and I think this is a clear issue. I thought this court's already found this is a clear issue. We just need a published decision here.
Well, if there aren't any other further questions, I think we have your case, Mr. Fogel, and we thank you for your argument. We'll move to the next and last case for the day.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.